This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News.
We have heard the connection between increasing incidents of extreme weather and those connections to climate change. But how tenuous are those connections? Is extreme weather increasing, and are those increases in extreme weather connected to the climate change crisis? Ross joins us this morning to talk about it. And I wonder, Ross, if it's something that you have found dangerous, in fact, to wade into the waters of making statements opposing climate change.
Well, I guess it must be because I don't hear many of my colleagues speaking out. And I do know in conversation, they talk about how exasperated they get at the controversies and the fact that if you try to say things publicly that go against the grain, you just know you're in for days of grief and abuse. In my case, the article that I wrote that got a lot of attention in the last week or two is outside of my own area of research. So I'm just reporting on what other people did, and I'm relying on IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and also Environment Canada statements. And you'd think that would be the safest possible grounds to make a case from, and yet still people think these conclusions are extremely controversial, but it's because they're the opposite of what they're being told.
I'm glad you brought up that area of expertise, because you and I have spoken before, and of course you are an economist at the University of Guelph, and here you are talking about all things climate science. So what led you to even do the work and write the piece as you did for the Financial Post?
Well, as an economist, I have a lot of training in statistics and data analysis, so I have done work in the physical sciences, usually as part of teams where we're doing data analysis on temperature and precipitation and things like that. So I'm quite familiar with a lot of the issues. This particular story struck me because there's an American meteorologist who worked in the area of extreme weather and insurance-related damages and the connection with climate change. And he was part of a team, he's in the mainstream on this issue, saying that, yes, the value of damages is going up, climate-related damages, weather-related damages, but it's going up more or less in step with the size of the economy. And when you take out the growth of population, the growth of the size of the economy, there isn't an underlying trend there that we could attribute to climate change. And that's part of a larger picture to do with extreme weather, where the underlying trends in a lot of things like hurricanes and droughts and tornadoes, they're not easy to spot. I mean, in one particular location over one particular time period, you might see an up or a down trend. But at the global level, these big assessment reports have pointed out that we don't actually see clear trends at the global scale. We might in the future, but at this point, the data doesn't support it. So in that sense, I can read just as easily as anyone else. So I'm just taking these sections of the report and reporting to people what the conclusions are. The scholar I mentioned, Roger Pielke Jr., he did the same thing in congressional testimony a few years ago, and he got so beat up, including a political campaign out of Washington to discredit him, so he ended up quitting the field. He got so tired of it, he left the field. So I was telling that story in the op-ed that I wrote, that here's a guy who works, this is his profession, he works in the mainstream, nothing he's saying should be controversial, and yet he got drummed out of his field for saying it publicly. Ironically, in response to that story, when the Milton MP, Lisa Raitt, tweeted the story, she then got so beat up and attacked that she deleted her tweet. And then that led me to write a letter to her and put it up on my website, pointing out, you know, there's a pattern here.
Right. And it was at first that letter that came to my attention. Then I backed up, found that piece in the Financial Post. And I want to come back, Ross, to that letter in just a moment. But before I ask about that, I find it intriguing that you have a fellow scholar who does this presentation, is beaten upon so badly, he leaves the field, and yet you still decide that you're going to stick your neck out in the same way. Why?
Well, first of all, because I'm in an economics department, there aren't the same repercussions for me. Like for Roger, it became very difficult for him to work in his chosen field. I mean, it begins to affect your eligibility for grants and your ability to collaborate with people. And so the cost was very high for him. In my case, I don't aspire to work in the field of tropical meteorology or things like that. So I'm in a position where I understand the issues. I follow the literature and I know the data, but it's not as costly for me to write these kinds of articles.
Why the open letter that you issued to MP Lisa Wright?
I wanted to, well, first of all, reach out in a friendly way to her. I mean, she had a pretty rough couple of days with the beating that she took. But I wanted to reinforce the point that, okay, you got essentially, so you got bullied into silencing yourself, deleting your tweet, and just leaving the whole subject alone. And that's a problem. This is something we need to be talking about. There are enormous policy implications. We're frequently being told things about changes in extreme weather and climate risks and so on that are at odds with the same sources we're supposed to consult, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Environment Canada, groups like that. We're being told frequently things that are directly opposed to what those groups have concluded. And on the basis of these claims, people are making extreme policy demands and putting forward far-reaching proposals. We need to be able to talk about this. We need to be able to put it all on the table and have an open discussion. And I concluded that letter with an anecdote. A friend of mine who grew up in Eastern Europe during the Soviet era, when he talked to me about the political correctness and the people afraid to talk about things, nobody willing to challenge what they were being told. And his observation, looking back on it, was we did that to ourselves. It wasn't imposed on the outside. It was just we imposed it on ourselves, and people were just afraid to speak out. So I think it's important that politicians understand that it's their job to talk about these things and make sure that we're all able to talk about it, because we definitely need to be debating these.
Have you had any contact with Lisa Wright?
No, I haven't.
Your op-ed first appeared in the Financial Post about a month ago now. What's been the response to you from that op-ed?
Well, a lot of very positive response, to be honest. I mean, I heard from people across the country who were really glad that I wrote those things, and I put them forward. There's been criticism, of course. I mean, people have written to me directly and to the paper, and I know there's lots of stuff on Twitter where people have challenged it. I followed up with a second op-ed where it more or less in response to the first one, the typical criticism was, well, there's more to these reports than the few sentences you quoted. So in my second op-ed, it was really just a brief introduction and then a whole series of full paragraph excerpts from the underlying reports. And it just reinforces the point over and over that these underlying reports don't back up what you're being told. And so again, with that op-ed coming out and with the letter to Lisa Wright, the main response that I've had is people are very grateful to have this information because they don't seem to be getting it anywhere else.
Is climate change something that we as people need to be concerned with?
Oh, sure. It's a big issue. It's a complex issue. It does command a lot of serious attention. I think one of the reasons people go to the extreme weather rhetoric side of it is that the idea of a long, slow warming trend on its own, and this is something in the IPCC reports as well, it's not difficult for societies to cope with and adapt to, and some places like Canada would probably end up slightly better off if we're really experiencing a long, slow warming trajectory for the next few decades or centuries, that on its own isn't something that would overwhelm our ability to respond to. The extreme weather rhetoric, though, to suggest every time there's a bad storm, to say, well, from now on, there's no, going to be nothing but bad storms, and we're going to have tornadoes all the time, and we're getting extreme. Every rainfall now is going to be an extreme flood. Trying to scare people, that I object to, because it's not true, for one thing, and it's trying to force people to accept extreme policy proposals that they wouldn't otherwise entertain, again, on false pretenses.
Would one of those extreme policy proposals be a carbon tax?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, a small carbon tax, which is more or less what the federal government is putting in place now, only has a small effect on prices, and then if the revenue is recycled back to businesses and households, the effect isn't onerous. By the same token, it doesn't actually reduce emissions very much. So it's kind of, that's a peripheral issue. It's just, you know, around at the edges, because that's not really the policy agenda that activists have in mind. They have in mind much more far-reaching goals. Like, for instance, in the UK, the Parliament just, in the blink of an eye, passed a resolution to go to what they call net zero by 2050, which is a complete cessation of all CO2 emissions. And that would be an extreme policy goal. And if actually pursued, would be ruinous for their economy. I don't even know how they would do it, but under current technology, unless there's some miracle technology. But those are the kinds of extreme policies that are being pushed. And the declaration of a climate emergency in Parliament, I'm not even sure what that's supposed to mean, but if that's a prelude to much more expensive and far-reaching policies than the carbon tax, then that's more of what I'm worried about.
Even right here in the city of Kitchener, just last week, council declared a climate emergency, and it has set as a target an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Would that be equally economically ruinous?
It would be. With current technology, with what we have now as far as cars, buildings, electricity systems, all the things that we use, we're very efficient, by the way. I mean, we use fuels in a very clean way, very efficient. But to eliminate 80% of fossil fuels, roughly speaking, you're thinking of taking 80% of the current fleet of cars off the road. What do you replace it with? I mean, at this point, the conversation always becomes very speculative, and people will glibly suggest we'll all be driving electric cars and we'll generate electricity with emissions-free sources. But first of all, that's all extremely expensive, and second, it's hardly even feasible, and the costs, as far as we can tell, would far outweigh any of the benefits. So that is an example of a very extreme policy proposal. And the people who vote for it usually have in mind that we have this crisis, this emergency, that the weather is all of a sudden going to turn crazy on us. And so that's the point where I'm trying to inject some of the scientific information and push back against it and say, I'm not going to let you get away with those kinds of claims. You told us to rely on the IPCC report and the experts at Environment Canada, and this is what they said. So I want to know why I should believe the rhetoric.
We touched briefly on the carbon tax, Ross, and we've been told that by and large, economists are supportive of such a task. As an economist, are you?
With an asterisk attached, a carbon tax in principle is a good way of achieving the goal of reducing emissions. And it does actually help the economy find the least costly way of reducing emissions. But that's only true when it's the only instrument you're using. If you try to couple it with a whole lot of extra regulations and mandates and subsidies and all kinds of other rules, then the efficiency of the carbon tax disappears. And it you end up with the worst of both worlds. I would be supportive of a small carbon tax as the approach to reducing CO2 emissions, but not in the context that we have now, where we have all kinds of climate-related regulations that they distort decision-making so much that the tax itself won't improve the picture.
So in light of today's climate, pun intended, and by climate I'm using it in this sense, in terms of the conversation we're having around crises, the climate change crisis that so many organizations, governments are declaring, is this all just rhetoric? Do you believe this is intended to drive a green economy, a whole new economy, and end up ultimately costing us more money?
Well, it's certainly a political campaign, and I don't really know anything about it. Like, there must be some kind of coordinating group out there, presumably with a large budget, who have put these motions in the hands of cities all around the world. And, it's not coincidence that all these cities, more or less simultaneously, are voting on this. Parliaments are voting on it. But it didn't arise because all of a sudden there is a change in the underlying data, or that the reports on this subject came to new conclusions. The information sources that we have tell us this maybe is something that we will see in the future, but at this point we don't see it now, and we probably would have expected to see it by now, I think, if the climate were really as sensitive to greenhouse gases as some people believe. So the fact that we're getting all these climate emergency declarations, to me, suggests there's some kind of political activist campaign at work that's done it, and there hasn't been enough time for people to think about it and really check the information and properly push back against the claims that are being made.
I'm sure, though, that you'd recognize that such a coordinated campaign would be pretty close to improbable, wouldn't it, on a scale of the nature that you're talking about?
Well, not really. Environmental groups are global in scope, and there are a lot of advocacy groups that work on this, so I'm assuming that it's some kind of a coordinated global activity. I don't think City Council in Kitchener just thought of this entirely independently of every other city council in Canada that thought of doing the same thing over the past few weeks.
It's a very interesting conversation indeed. Ross, I appreciate your time on this today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
The Mike Farwell Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 570 News.